are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
Oh, it's casual Friday. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the four-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape. Steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. Oh, it's the final day of our vacation. Woe is us. Woe is us. Maybe woe is you, because we've given you all new material the whole week. Maybe you've loved it. Maybe you wish it wouldn't stop. I mean, we're going to give you new material next week, too, but I don't know. I'm not a mind reader. Stop expecting me to always know how you're reacting to things. It's the final day of vacation, folks. On today's program, David Daly, author of Rat Effed, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. This outlines how the Republicans went about locking in majorities in state houses around the country, locking in majorities in the House by redistricting. I've referenced this dynamic in the past. You probably heard it in other places. Now you're going to really understand how they went about doing it. Very important to know both how they did it, what the Democrats are doing or not doing to fight it, to deal with it. Perhaps the sine qua non of what's going to happen in the years to come in terms of legislation and both in states across the country, but also in the federal government. Because until the Democrats figure out how to win the House back, it's just going to be a mess. So check that out. It is Friday. We'll be back live on Monday. Not sure if it'll be Michael or I. And over the weekend, it is going to be my daughter Mila's birthday party. So there's going to be a sleepover. There's going to be a lot of preteen, a lot of tweeners. I'm going to be dealing with a lot of tweeners. But it is the final day of vacation for me. Well, not quite. I mean, over the weekend, I'm going to be still on vacation. But you know what that means. On Monday or Tuesday, I'll be available to do Hayes, and I will have to shave. And my beard at this point is probably extremely thick. Because I'm already now, when we're recording this, a week before I'm talking, it's already starting to come in. It's going to be a problem, right? How am I going to do that? What am I going to do? Go to a barber? Am I going to pour Nair all over it or whatever it is? Gross. No, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to shave with the only razor I've found that I enjoy shaving with. Well, period, frankly. But particularly when my beard is this thick. Big razor companies have the annoying habit of putting out new models, raising their already high prices. But unlike those guys, Harry doesn't believe in upcharging. So they have made their existing razors. If you haven't tried Harry's in a while, you got to try them again. If you never tried it, then this is your day. They keep the prices exactly the same. Harry's five-blade razors include a softer flex hinge for more comfortable glide, a trimmer blade for hard-to-reach places. For me, that's, you know, like my nose area. I don't know where it is for other people. They shave maybe their ears. I don't know why would you do that. But lubricating strip textured handle for more control when it's wet. Still just $2 a blade compared to $4 or more you'll pay at the drugstore. Quality 100% guaranteed. If you don't love your shave, they'll fully refund you. I love shaving with Harry's. Gave my dad a razor, a Harry's razor, for Father's Day. He loved it. Now we're a happy family for the first time in decades. Now, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but he really did love the Harry's. The Harry's starter set is an amazing deal. You get a weighted razor handle of your choice, moisturizing shave cream, 3 precision engineered 5-blade cartridges, and a travel cover just for $15. However, if you've never tried Harry's before, guess what? $5 off. Yeah. All you need is the promo code Majority Report. And go to harrys.com right now. Enter the code Majority Report at checkout. You get $5 off if it's your first time you're buying razors. So that's $10 for the cartridges, the razor handle, the lubricating strip, the shave cream. Are you kidding me? The travel cover. That's harrys.com, code Majority Report. All right, quick break. Then we're going to get to Dave Daly. And then Matt may have a special Matt pick for members. All right, folks. Enjoy this. We'll be back live next week. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program David Daly. He is the former editor-in-chief at Salon and the author of Rat Fucked, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Welcome to the program, Dave.
Real pleasure to be here, Sam. Thank you for having me.
So as I was saying to you before we started this, you know, this dynamic of the redistricting in 2010 by the Republican Party is something that I have referenced and have explained sort of very in very broad strokes the nature of the concept, but I haven't seen anything that is even remotely close to the level of detail and just the granular study of this, which is really important because there has been, it seems to me, and you tell me if you've experienced this, a pushback on this thesis to a certain extent.
Yes, I think that the media and the smarty pants set within sort of the political blogosphere world, the political scientists, they don't understand that gerrymandering and redistricting changed forever in 2010. Yes, it goes back to the beginning of the dawn of the Republic and Patrick Henry and Elbridge Gerry in 1788 and 1790, but the kind of gerrymandering that happened between 1790 and 2000 is one era, and what the Republicans did in 2010 is completely different, and it needs to be understood as a rat fucking. It needs to be understood in a completely different way to get our hands around what happened.
All right. Well, let's just look at the results for a moment. Let's look at that pregnant rat, as it were. We have a situation now where Donald Trump, the Republican nominee, and we don't know, but I think, like, you know, if you look at the odds makers, has a increasingly decreasing chance of becoming president. And I have been saying for a while that for several cycles that the Republicans were going to have trouble with this. Yet they dominate on the state level. I mean, give us just some set the table for us in terms of, like, what they did in 2010 has produced at this point. And it goes beyond electoral results, too.
It does. When you draw the lines, you make the rules. And really, you have to go back to election night in 2008, when Barack Obama is elected president. Democrats take a supermajority in the United States Senate, retain the House. People are talking about a coalition of the ascendant, that the Democrats are demographically unbeatable for a generation. If you go back and watch live TV from that night, you've got Rich Lowry, you've got Laura Ingraham, you've got all of these Republicans wringing their hands about the future of the party. They don't think that there is one. What Republican strategists realized in the days after this was that 2008 would not matter if they could win big in 2010, which is a census year and it's a redistricting year, that the Constitution mandates that every 10 years we redraw every line in the country, and that happens after the census in years ending in zero. So if you can win big in a zero year, it reverberates throughout the course of the next decade. And Karl Rove lays the plan out in the Wall Street Journal in March of 2010. This is not hidden. This is not a secret. Rove explains how there were 18 state legislative chambers which only four or fewer seats separated the two parties, and that they were key redistricting states. Democrats had 11 of those 18, including important houses in Ohio, Wisconsin, Pennsylvania,
Michigan.
The Republicans, Michigan, North Carolina. What the Republicans did was they focused on about 107 seats in 16 states, and they knew that by winning those 107 state legislative seats, they could control the drawing of district lines for 190 U.S. congressional seats. And that's exactly what they did. And you can do that for a song, because throwing a lot of money to influence state legislative races is cheap. It's the biggest bargain in politics. This only cost the Republicans $30 million. It would have cost them $110 million simply to continue contesting these seats over the course of the next decade. Instead, they redistricted them. They drew almost impossible to defeat lines, and they took these seats off the table for the next decade.
All right, so let's talk about, there's two sides to this coin in terms of how they did this, in terms of the concept, the cracking and packing. Describe what those two are.
Well, essentially, packing is when you try to stick as many Democratic votes as you can into one district. Cracking, on the other hand, is trying to divide the Democratic vote amongst as many districts as you can in a way that it is completely ineffectual.
And this is all done, I mean, obviously, people are not moving. It is all done by simply moving the lines of any given district.
Yes. The political smarty pants set would like you to think that this is all the big sort, that we have sorted ourselves into these districts. If you simply look at the maps, and if you look at the math, you can see that that's not the case. The best example is Pennsylvania. In 2008, Barack Obama wins at Pennsylvania. Democratic House candidates in Pennsylvania win about 100,000 more votes than Republican candidates. The exact same scenario plays out in 2012. Obama wins, and House Republican candidates get about 100,000 more votes, except in 2008, that's enough to elect 12 Democrats to Congress. In 2012, that same margin elects five. What happened in between there? It's not that people moved.
Right.
It's that the lines changed in 2010 and 2011.
And Pennsylvania, I mean, is the most dramatic swing, isn't it, I think, of all the states?
I think Pennsylvania is especially dramatic because it is essentially a blue state, and Pennsylvania has 18 members of Congress. 13 of them are Republicans, and 12 of those 13 districts are drawn in such a way that they are more Republican than the rest of America. This is all about how you draw the lines. When you draw the lines, you make the rules.
I just want to reiterate this so that people can really understand it. So it's a 13-5 delegation in Pennsylvania, even though the Democrats, right? The Democrats won 100,000?
The Democrats get more votes. The Republicans take 70% of the seats. because they have so effectively packed the Democratic vote into a handful of districts around Philadelphia and Pittsburgh. So the Democrats win those seats with 75-80% of the vote. Republicans take all the rest of the seats.
And they win anywhere from like 5-10% of the vote. Or
exactly.
And so exactly. They disperse their winnings out across the spectrum of these other districts. And
they try to take as many as they can without risking them all. You don't want to spread it too thin.
Right.
But you can see this in some states. In North Carolina, that they once saved an email plan of, excuse me, in North Carolina, they once saved a computer map of the state under the name, Just Dreaming a Little Bit Too Much. And that was one in which they were trying to take one or two extra seats that they knew they probably shouldn't take. The same thing in Ohio, which is a 50-50 state. I mean, Ohio is the ultimate bellwether. It keeps us up,
right,
you know, until midnight waiting for Tim Russert to tell us who was president back in 2004. It's a 50-50 state in just about every way. It's congressional delegation of 16, 12, 4 Republicans. These lines are drawn in such a way as to turn split votes into strong, unbeatable Republican majorities.
All right. So tell us about the plan was called Red Map, right?
Yeah.
Redistricting Majority Project. Who was
yes.
behind this? Like, how did this? I mean, it's amazing to me that, I mean, I had always assumed, like, okay, this was a plan that they had been working on from like 2004, and they were getting ready to execute it by and it comes up in a matter of months. They're able to basically generate this plan and begin to execute.
It is run by a group called the Republican State Leadership Committee. Its executive director is a brilliant strategist named Chris Jankowski. The group is run by Ed Gillespie. And Jankowski hits on this reading a New York Times story that mentions the census and redistricting. And he says, wait a second, this is what we can do. He's a state government guy. So he understands that most of these lines, 42 of 50 states, state legislatures are in the catbird seat when it comes to drawing lines. So he starts taking a look at the process. And he goes state by state, especially in states that were likely to gain or lose a member of Congress after the census as you reapportion. And he looked at the rules in each of these states. In some states, you have to have the governor in both houses. In some states, it's just the legislature. In some states, you have a committee of people responsible for redistricting, but they're appointed largely by the governor or the legislature. And what they tried to do was take complete control of the redistricting process in as many states as they could in such a way that the Democrats did not even have a seat at the table. So if in Pennsylvania the governor and the state Senate and House are in charge of redistricting, they wanted to control all three of those seats. Same thing in Ohio, where there's an apportionment committee. They wanted every member of that committee that they could get their hands on. And that's what the key was of Red Map, was identifying enough state house districts where they could go in, knock out Democratic incumbents, flip control of state legislative chambers. I mean, after 2010, this is so effective that the Democrats control two-thirds of all state legislative chambers in the country.
The Republicans
and the other
do.
Key to, yes, excuse me. And the key to this is that they're able to mount this takeover in blue and purple states. So the biggest Republican gains come in Ohio, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, North Carolina, Florida, battleground states, all of which are dominated in the congressional level and often now in the state houses where these gerrymanders are just as important.
Did they choose those states? I mean, let's say there's a matrix, right, in terms of how they choose those states. Did they choose them? I mean, it makes sense to me, obviously, that you would do this in a purple state, right? Because if it's 50-50, it's much easier than if it was like 70-30 to rejigger this stuff. And if it's 70-30 in favor of Republicans, there's not as many fish in that pond, as it were,
exactly.
Because you probably already dominate it. So that's one factor. And then I guess they also sort of cross-reference that with the ease in which you control the redistricting process. And then were there other sort of major factors there? Was the fact that they were swing states necessarily? I mean, that to me, that's more coincidental, right? Because, of course, your purple states are going to be your swing states, and your purple states are where you have both the best opportunity to sort of to use this process, and there's slash the most opportunity.
Yes, I think you have the most opportunity in those states. A lot of those states as well are sort of industrial Midwestern states that often are losing population. I mean, Pennsylvania lost a member after 2010. That delegation went from 19 to 18, so it meant that the entire state was going to be scrapped and the entire state had to be redrawn. North Carolina was going to gain, so you knew that the entire state was going to be remapped.
And so
that matters.
Yes, okay. It means that a wholesale change is almost sort of like required anyways, right? I mean, because we're trying to make 18 out of 19. And so...
Exactly.
And so now you walked several of the districts in some of these states, right? I mean, you went in Michigan, you went to, I think it's the... Was it
the 14th in Michigan.
Yeah. Tell me what it looks like on the ground when you're looking at a district that has been so stitched together, I guess.
It is, in a way, you almost can't understand it until you drive these streets. I mean, on the maps, these districts look bizarre. They look like Rorschach tests, and people have a good time, you know, making fun of how crazy they look. But the technology is so good right now that when you get out there and when you draw these districts in such a way that they have those crazy turns, when you see them in person, every single one of those turns is there for a reason. It's not arbitrary. It's not funny. It's very serious. They are there to grab a few houses here and grab a few houses there, and they know with great specificity these days, because of all of the technology and because of all of the databases that are hooked up to these mapping systems, who is in those houses and how they're likely to vote. So none of this is coincidental. I went out to Michigan and I drove every mile of the 14th, which starts in some of the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit. And the entire goal of the 14th is to link the poorest neighborhoods in Detroit with the African-American city of Pontiac. The goal is to pack as many Democrats as possible into this one district that Brenda Lawrence now carries with between 75 and 80% of the vote. It makes all of these other districts that kind of candy swirl in a really kind of Willy Wonka psychedelic lollipop kind of way off of the 14th out. It makes them all much more Republican. And as a result, Michigan is one of those states where in 2012, the first elections run on these maps, 240,000 more votes for Democratic House candidates than Republicans, and yet Michigan's delegation is 9-5 Republican. And when you drive this and when you go turn by turn, you can see the neighborhoods change, you can see the houses change, sometimes one side of the street to another. You can take two turns and there's a and you know, one school is perfectly manicured and there is a radar gun outside telling you how fast you're driving, and another school two or three blocks away looks completely run down. These lines often etch the very difference between hope and despair on these streets, and they pack as much of the despair as they can into one district while trying to take as many Republican voters as possible, not waste them, and slide them into these other districts.
And so I guess to a certain extent, like, this couldn't have happened really in 2000, in the year 2000, just simply because
the technology wasn't good enough.
I mean, that's, I mean, this is like a, this is very much like sort of a, like a first entry type of story, right? Like where.
Yes. And that's why the political scientists and the media doesn't fundamentally get it. We want to think that this is politics as usual, that both sides do it, that it's gone on forever. It's different now. It's different.
Because there's never been a time where you could be
exactly
that granular about,
yes,
which houses literally are going to get you the votes. Because it used to be old time polls would say, like, oh, okay, I want this neighborhood more or less because I know I generally,
yeah,
do well in that neighborhood. But
yep,
they can do it down to the vote with such precision that they can actually say, okay, this district we're creating, this is going to be an R2 district now, where it used to be, you know, even, or an R3 district. Now, this is, I'm talking the for folks at home, the,
yes,
the partisan index.
Where
they, and so they now basically make out of six districts that may be, even districts, just for the sake of argument, they now have the ability to make four of those R3s and two of those D20s. Essentially.
And you can be so sure that an R2 will always be an R2 because you know exactly who those voters are, you know who turns out, and you know the history of these votes, and you can get all of the election information. You can upload it into the Maptitude program that draws these maps, and you can draw the lines and see how they change when you move one street one way. You can draw districts that look competitive that are not competitive because you know how the districts are going to perform.
Right. And we should say that, I mean, to a certain extent, it was just the luck of having lost so badly in 2008 that forced Republican strategists to think in this way, right? I mean, it seems to me conceivable that if the Democrats had lost in 2008 and they had this technology, that strategy may have occurred to somebody. I'm not sure that the Democrats could have gotten it together to do it. But to the extent that this strategy was out there, where Karl Rove is writing about it in the Wall Street Journal, was there any type of Democratic response? Because I got to say, the first thing that occurs to me is you had Howard Dean, who had a 50-state strategy, which at the very least would be geared up to perhaps respond defensively. But he is booted in 2008, mm-hmm, for Tim Kaine.
Right.
And my experience in show business is if you've got a show in development and the president of the network leaves, you are tainted. Even if you're still there, that idea is just like toxic, and the new person wants to bring in their own ideas.
Yes. I mean, Tim Kaine in 2010 oversees a catastrophic strategic failure on behalf of the Democratic Party. I mean, I don't know if nobody was reading the Wall Street Journal that day or what, but I mean, Karl Rove announces this plan in flashing neon lights. This is what we're going to do. If you control redistricting, you control America. He rattles off the towns in which they're going to go to. I mean, it's Howard Dean-esque in a way. We're going to win Portsmouth, Ohio, and West Lafayette, Indiana. Yahoo! You know, and that's what they go off and do. Chris Jankowski, when I talked to him, I said, you must have been waiting for the Democrats to do something. And he's like, I'm out in Michigan, in Wisconsin, in Ohio, in September and October, and I keep figuring that at some point the Democratic money is going to come in these races. And he's like, it never, ever did. The Democrats didn't see this kind of paradigm shift. They lacked the imagination to come up with it on their own. And then they couldn't play defense when Karl Rove announced what they were going to do in the Wall Street Journal.
Well, to be fair, they didn't have the same sort of urgency and necessity, I think, for the idea. But the real question is once it becomes clear, I mean, it seems
they
like they were asleep at the wheel.
The
yes. I mean,
yes.
Did you talk to any Democratic, anybody who was
yes.
involved? And what did they say? Like, oh, we missed it.
Yeah, they said we whistled past the graveyard. And they didn't have to come up with the idea, but once it was announced that this was what the Republicans were doing, they had to understand that this was going to have an effect for the next decade.
Well, that's what
I mean,
I'm asking.
2000,
was the response yeah. like, we knew it was happening, we just didn't think it was relevant, or we had no idea what it was happening, or we didn't understand, I tried to convince people in the office, and
yeah.
they wouldn't listen to me.
No. You talk to Democrats and they say, you know, our house was on fire because we had all the Obamacare stuff, all the town halls, the Tea Party, death panels. But this didn't require a 50-state strategy necessarily. It required knowing what those 110 seats that the Republican strategists were focused on and being sure that the candidates in those districts had the money to play defense. It didn't require great vision. It required reading an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal and understanding that the consequences of this would effectively doom Obama's presidency. I mean, the House becomes the key obstacle for everything the president wants to do. And it will continue to be an obstacle for everything Hillary Clinton wants to do, because this is not going to change this year, no matter how big a landslide Hillary wins. She's probably going to be looking at the same 234-201 House that Barack Obama was looking at after 2012.
And we should say it's not just a federal story. I mean, you've got states where right-to-work laws have come in
yes.
places like Wisconsin. You've got anti-abortion laws.
The transgender bathroom law in North Carolina. I mean the emergency manager law
in
Flint.
Michigan, yeah.
All of these are passed by gerrymandered legislatures in states where Republicans are in the minority.
In terms of this sort of, you know, on a national level, the not paying attention to it in 2010, at what point does the Democratic Party realize, like, oh, gosh, we really messed up big time. We're in trouble here. And what is the response at that point? Because, like, as you're describing Michigan, and you're describing that that district, one district that has, you know, the Democratic congresswoman wins by whatever it is, 50% or 60% percentage points. I got to think that, like, she's not in a huge hurry to change things up a little bit.
I think that's exactly right. I think that when you are a congressman or woman with a safe seat, you enjoy that safe seat. And that's part of the problem, that the Democrats just in general lacked that kind of urgency. I think it became very clear in the redistricting process of 2011 that the Republicans were handling this in a different way than this has been done before. Map making used to be a fairly public process, and it would be a somewhat bipartisan process. It was honor amongst thieves. They were sort of looking out for their incumbents, and they were drawing their lines. In 2011 in Ohio, Republicans rent a suite at the DoubleTree. They dub it the Bunker. And they barricade themselves in there for months and won't let anybody in. it won't even mention the name DoubleTree in their emails. It has to be, we're at the bunker or we're at the undisclosed location. In Wisconsin, it's the same kind of thing. They move redistricting from the Capitol into a law firm across the street. They require Republican incumbents, even, who want to get a look at their new district, to sign a non-disclosure agreement. In North Carolina, they bring in this guy, Tom Hofeller, who is the master map maker, who has these rules. He's like, you do not leave your computer up if
right.
you walk away from it. You do not fire the staff until
we're done
all
with
of the
project.
Maps have been completely approved. You don't send out any emails. You don't tell anybody what you are doing. And in Florida, it's the same thing. I mean, in Florida, voters passed a constitutional amendment mandating a fair district amendment, and Republicans found a way around that by setting up a fancy shadow redistricting process in which they created unbelievably detailed, perfect algorithmic maps, and they filtered them into the legislative process through phony email addresses of former Republican interns.
Jeez.
And wives of county chairmen. It's a completely different process than you've ever seen before.
So we are now at 2016. This is before 2020. We got one more bite, I guess, at the apple, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is 2020.
Yeah.
Theoretically, 2018, but it has to be done by 2020, because
exactly.
these state houses and these off-year elections and governor mansions. So, what have they come up with at this point, the Democrats? I mean,
the Democrats have a plan called Advantage 2020 that is sort of their version of Red Map. They're trying to raise $75 million to mount a campaign like the Republicans did and try and be prepared and be in a good shape for redistricting.
Are the Republicans coming up with their own super advantage 2020, where we raise $120 million?
Funny you ask. It's exactly that, except worse. A couple days after the Democrats made their announcement, Republicans said, oh, yeah, so we're going to run a Red Map too, by the way, and we've got $125 million
right.
set aside for it. So the Democrats are going to have less money. They're not going to have the element of surprise that the Republicans hit them with in 2010. And they've got the hardest task of all, which is they still have to win on these tilted maps. So it is really, really uphill. And they have to win on these tilted maps state by state. They have to take back chambers. They have to earn themselves back seats at the table that the Republicans took away from them in 2010. It's very, very hard to do.
And just to be clear to people, people should understand that these districts are they're congressional districts, but they're also function as state Senate districts and state House districts.
Exactly.
And so, all right. So there's one other element that happens in 2013, and that is the Voting Rights Act is, at least in some ways, hobbled by the Supreme Court. Does that in any way implicate any of this stuff? Because it seems to me, and then I want to get into the efficiency gap, which is this sort of right now, at least from a legal perspective, the Democrats. It seems to me to be, I wouldn't call it a Hail Mary pass, but it seems to be their go-to legal principle. But was this in any way implicated by what happened with the Voting Rights Act? I mean, could theoretically, in some of these counties, if they fell within the preclearance, could this have been problematic in some way, or is it completely untethered from the Voting Rights Act?
A lot of this is related and a lot of it is untethered. And I think the Voting Rights Act has a complicated history when it comes to redistricting. In a lot of these states in the 1990s, Republicans came up with another plan. I mean, Lee Atwater in 1989, after putting George H.W. Bush in the White House, he becomes chair of the RNC, and he takes a look at the South, and he brings his new RNC counsel, Ben Ginsburg, in, and he says, Ben, you're going to do something about redistricting. And what Ginsburg comes up with is an unholy alliance with African-American Democrats in the South and Republicans to use the Voting Rights Act in states like North Carolina and others to pack as many Democrats as possible into majority-minority seats and bleach all of the surrounding districts white for Republicans. So the first turn, in some ways, of the Republican strategy to turn the House bright red comes from a clever manipulation of the Voting Rights Act. It does, in fact, increase African-American representation.
But it does
in the House, but it also has the consequence of giving the Republicans a majority of seats in states like Georgia, Tennessee, and North Carolina, states where there had been more Democrats than Republicans in the past.
And we should say part of that
flips after 1994.
And part of that also, though, is still, I think, in some ways, it seems to me, the sort of the lagging, or is this the argument that, part of that, my understanding has always been, is that sort of the remnants of the realignment that really even began in 1965, where
I think that's right too.
There were in southern states, people were they gave up on they became Republicans in terms of local, more localized in state politics much later, just out of sort of sheer tradition, where the Dixiecrats there began to sort of align even on a state level with what was going on the national parties. So, okay, so let's talk about the efficiency gap, because of there seems to be really, there's three ways that this is going to change. One is the Democrats are going to outwit the Republicans and outraise the Republicans and run and take back these districts, which is a steep hill, to say the least. The other is potential referendums to create independent, legitimately independent commissions that would do redistricting come 2020, which seems to me to be one of the better options, right?
Absolutely. These referendums are very popular in red states, blue states, purple states. Absolutely.
I mean, because it seems to me if I'm a billionaire, and somebody comes to me and I have Democratic leanings, so it says, I want $10 million to run specific races in Pennsylvania, or I can spend that $10 million on a referendum that will make it independent. I would think the referendum is going to give me a better shot, right?
Because it would give you a better bang for your buck, and it would have a more lasting impact.
But shouldn't that referendum have happened this cycle?
It really should have, and now that said, it's really hard to do in some states. Not every state allows referendums. North Carolina, for example, this year people were trying to do that, and the gerrymandered state legislature actually passes a law saying
you can't
have a referendum on gerrymandering. So the politicians who draw these lines do not want to give up this power. And in a lot of ways, the fierceness with which they cling to this power ought to be a signal to us of exactly how important it is.
Right, of course. And all right, so let's talk about the other way, which is through the courts. What's the efficiency gap?
The efficiency gap essentially is the difference between wasted votes, that is, votes that have been cracked or packed in such a way that they do not have a fair representation in the final results, divided by the total votes. So essentially, the efficiency gap tries to measure the undeserved share of seats that a party wins, the proportion of seats that a party would not have received if the lines weren't drawn in such a way as to go out and waste them. this is central to a case.
Let me just explicate this for people so in that scenario that we talked about where you had the six districts and they were all 50-50, and now you've got four districts that Republicans win by 10% and two districts where Democrats win by 40% or 50% each. The difference, the delta between the 10% and the 40% or 50%, you take that and then you divide it by the total number of votes that all those six districts represent. And that gives you a number, which is a metric. And it's not arbitrary. I mean, we can see how it's developed, but it's a metric as to weigh the disparity between what's happening in the Republican winning district and the Democratic winning district.
That is a much better way of explaining it in the convoluted way in which I just did. Yes, thank you.
So that is important that people have figured out how to calculate that number, because why?
Well, because the Supreme Court has never weighed in and said that a partisan gerrymander is a bad thing. The last time a case reached the Supreme Court, it's the Veef case out of Pennsylvania in the 2000s, in which a bunch of Democrats in Pennsylvania were frustrated by the way district lines were drawn and sued and said that their votes didn't count because of partisan gerrymandering. The court in a 5-4 decision said no to them. And Justice Kennedy, though, while siding with the five who threw the case out, said that he was open to a standard on partisan gerrymandering if someone could show him one that actually worked. I guess it's funny that the Supreme Court over the years has said that they can't define pornography, but they know it
when they see it.
When they see it. A partisan gerrymandering, on the other hand, they don't know it.
You need a quotient.
When they see it.
We need a mathematical
formula for that. So that set a bunch of political scientists and stats nerds and law professors off to try to find the formula that would be aimed straight at Justice Kennedy, trying to give him a justiciable standard to show objectively when partisan gerrymandering was at work. And that's what the efficiency gap is trying to do. And if this case can reach the Supreme Court, there is the possibility that the court could institute a standard that would stop all of this gamesmanship.
Where is that case now, as it's working its way through the legal bloodstream?
It has just come through the Wisconsin Court of Appeals circuit, so it is headed towards the court.
And that's a big case, and that really it obviously
it's the biggest gerrymandering case potentially in decades. Yes,
and it puts a fine point on the point of who gets to appoint that fifth Supreme Court justice. David Daley, thank you so much for coming on. This is I know that people are going to listen to this a couple of times, because this is, I think, one of the this is such an important and primary issue to where the country goes from here, and it is also it tells the story of why the Republican Party, on one hand, controls so much of our state governments and our House of Representatives, but on the other hand, when it comes to statewide elections or national elections like the presidency, they cannot. And you know, I mean, we could go on and talk about how this increases polarization, because, you know, you got a lot of people who are talking only to their Republican voters in their district because they're locked into these gerrymandering. And so
absolutely
they
correct.
Go down a wormhole that when they have to talk to the rest of the country, and we are seeing it right now, folks, when Donald Trump, you got journalists who say, like, when Donald Trump ran into these mistakes in the Republican primary, it worked fine. He always recovered immediately, and it added 2 points to his polls. Well, now he's running, frankly, in an election with normal people, not just Republican voters. And it's caused this sort of dissonance. And this is why. So, David Daley, the book is Rat Fucked, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. We will link to it at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you so much for the conversation.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know. Shifted in and out of gear.